This is the Education Gadfly Show.
And there are images now out there on the internet.
There are. People should try to find them. It's worth a laugh.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man nominated for 10 Golden Globes, Eric Larum.
Hey, Mike. Thanks.
How are you? Eric, if you were to be nominated for a Golden Globe, what category do you think you'd be in?
Oh, gosh. Probably screenwriter.
Yeah, I was going to go for that, too. That's the dream. Yeah, of all of us.
Behind the scenes.
Yes.
Behind the scenes.
A writer.
Yes.
Very nice.
Maybe director.
Ooh, director.
Yeah.
You like to tell people what to do?
Sure. Why not?
All right.
Directing movies looks like fun.
Speaking of telling people what to do, that is what Students First is all about this week, is telling people what to do. Telling people what to do. Hey, Eric is the Vice President for National Policy at Students First, known to many people as Michelle Rhee's organization. They came out with a big report card on state policy this week. We're going to talk about that and other happenings in the world of education reform this week. So, let's get started. Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
On Monday, Students First released their 2013 state policy report card. What can you tell us about it?
And by the way, you have 2 minutes or less.
2 minutes or less. What about the state policy report card? So what we did is we took our policy agenda. Students First has a policy agenda, shock to a lot of people. But we took our policies and we took 24 of them and graded 50 states plus DC on how well they were doing it. What we were looking for were the policy environments in place at the state level. How well are states enabling strong school leaders, district leaders to do their jobs, to give them the flexibility to innovate? How much are they empowering teachers to get results in the classroom, and how much are they empowering parents to make the best decisions possible for their kids? We took those policies and analyzed them, and then created descriptions, and then graded the states on the policy environments that exist.
All right, so Eric, which ones are the reformiest states?
The reformiest states, top five are Louisiana, Florida, Indiana, and then D.C. and Rhode Island.
Okay. Now, you know, a lot of people have been nitpicking your various indicators. You know, it's not nuanced enough. You left some things out. And that's always the case in these big comprehensive reports. But when you step back and you look at the states that rose to the top, I think most people in the reform community would say those are the right states.
I think that's right. I think what's interesting is we've had all this activity in the last 3 to 5 years, and that's what you're seeing. You're seeing states that have taken big sweeping changes. Those are the ones that are up at the top. The one state that stands out there, really two states, Florida and Tennessee, they've been at this a little longer than other states. They show up at the top, sort of maybe the trendsetters, the pace setters for the other states.
All right. Now, a lot of criticism saying some of the states that are at the top, like Louisiana, like D.C., not known for having high NAEP scores. So doesn't this just prove that there's no relationship between the reform agenda and student achievement?
I don't see how it proves that. I mean, to me, D.C. and Louisiana, they're great examples. They do have abysmal NAEP rankings and NAEP scores, and therefore they're the ones that are adopting the reformiest policies. They're the ones that are saying, enough of this, let's do something about it. Mm-hmm. A lot of that focus is on the 2011 NAEP scores. These policies were put in place in 2010, 2011, 2012. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we've begun to see the results that are coming about these policy changes.
And you can point to Florida has got a long-standing reform track record and big gains on NAEP over that time. One other criticism, people saying, hey, this is basically a Republican agenda that you are pushing. Is that fair?
I don't think it's quite fair. When we looked at it, typically talk about red states versus blue states. When we looked at our top 10 states, seven of them were blue states. They voted for Obama. When we looked at the bottom 12 states, eight of those were Romney states. They were red states. So I don't think that there's a way to say that this is anything but bipartisan.
Okay, topic number two.
New Jersey's biggest teacher union, the NJEA, is suing to stop charter schools from using blended learning in the classroom. Are they doing something illegal?
Are the unions doing something illegal? Or are the charter schools? So this is interesting, right? We have seen unions fight tooth and nail against online learning since its inception in terms of the big online charter schools like the ones run by K-12 or online courses kids can take. But this seems a little bit new. We're talking about blended learning, kids spending time in computer labs during the school day in brick and mortar classrooms in schools that have teachers. Right. What is up with this?
I don't know. It seems pretty crazy to me. I mean, first of of all, we're not hearing this about any of the traditional districts that are experimenting with blended learning and online learning, and certainly those exist in New Jersey. But it, you know, this really comes at there's an absence in New Jersey law, as there is in many states, where they haven't yet defined what digital learning looks like, what a virtual classroom looks like. And so I think these charter schools are operating under the extent of the law, and certainly the state is mm-hmm. authorizing them. And so this question about whether they're allowed to do that, you know, I don't see anything they're doing illegal for
sure. Well, now my understanding is that there's something in the statute saying that kids have to be taught by a certified teacher. And so mm-hmm. they're trying to make the case that if kids are spending a significant amount of time in front of a computer being taught by somebody else, somewhere else, or self-instructed, that doesn't meet the criteria. I mean, of course, it's hard not to see this as just basic self-interested behavior. This is like bank tellers trying to protest ATMs moving in, right? I mean, and you understand why. I mean, it is true that in many of these blended models, part of the idea is to get by with fewer teachers and to reinvest that money in other things. Having kids on the computer part of the time, but then having smaller class sizes or groupings or all sorts of things. And so and this is certainly one way to have more efficiency in education. Now some people say, look, when we're talking about blended learning, online learning, we shouldn't even raise the cost issue because of this. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't think that's fair at all. I think we have to look at trying to figure out what resources kids need to learn and what environment you can provide. And to me, this whole issue gets at exactly the problem we have right now, which is everybody's focused on sort of the system and the rules that are in place and not focused on, hey, how can we innovate to get kids a better education? What can we put in front of them? Mm-hmm. What different ways can we do it to try and reach kids that otherwise just aren't learning in a traditional classroom setting? That's what we need to be focused on.
Okay, topic number three, Pamela.
On Sunday, the Washington Post reported that D.C.'s charter schools expel many more students than do the city's traditional schools. Is this a problem?
Eric?
Yeah, I think it's an issue when students aren't in the classroom. I think that we need to make sure that we're keeping students in the classroom as much as possible, that we're getting the services they need. That said, it is no secret that whether charter schools are expelling these students or whether traditional public schools are sort of just banishing these students to, dropout factories and sort of the worst classrooms within schools or whatever, and sort of hiding these kids and passing them along, and then they graduate or maybe they get to a place where they drop out and they're totally unprepared. Either way, what we're talking about is schools aren't serving students. And so we need to be looking at making sure, again, we have schools in place, that we have programs in place that are serving students with mm-hmm. all sorts of different needs. I don't think that every single school has to be a one-size-fits-all approach.
So the findings in D.C. made it look like the charter schools had a dramatically higher expulsion rate than the public schools. Though, as some people have said, look, this is apples to oranges. There are lots of ways for the public school system, as you said, to hide kids that mm-hmm. they're basically kicking out of a particular school, send them somewhere else, mm-hmm. maybe wink, wink, nod, nod, encourage them to drop out, and those kids don't get counted. In a charter setting, either they're in that school or they're not. And so if they are asked to leave, that's an expulsion. Still, there's some charter schools that are looked at that have, a lot. I mean, dozens and dozens of kids a year that are getting kicked out. And people say, look, that's not fair. Those kids get kicked out. They go back to the public school system, and that system becomes the system of last resort. And so now the charters get to cream, and the public schools have to deal with the toughest kids.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's why I think D.C. is the perfect environment to really tackle a problem like this, because you can do it in a way that puts the onus on the state to make sure that we have schools that are serving these kids. If it's not a particular charter school that is best equipped to serve those students, we shouldn't force the charter school to keep the kid there. Likewise, we shouldn't allow district schools, traditional public schools, to keep kids and not be, not making sure that they're being educated, not making sure that they're right. getting the credits they need to graduate.
No, I mean, I think, look, the chartering authority in D.C. should work on creating more schools for these kinds of kids. We already have some schools like that. Yeah. And we've got Maya Angelou is for kids mm-hmm. Who are adjudicated. More schools within the charter sector so that we could say, look, we're not sending these kids back to the traditional public schools. They're staying in the charter sector. But we are allowing schools, and all schools should have this freedom, I think, public schools too, to decide if kids are disruptive, they are not going to stay, because we have got to pay attention to the needs of the other kids.
I agree. In the meantime, I think all schools do need to take a very close look at their discipline policies, though, and make sure that they're not just, removing kids from classrooms that they shouldn't be removing.
Okay. That is all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Well played, Eric. Well played. If you didn't live in Sacramento, I'd have you on all the time.
Wow. Thank you.
Okay. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber. Amber. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
You were at the Big Students First event this morning.
I was.
With Eric. And we were just talking about how one of the funnest parts about it was how Rick, imagining Rick driving a Mini Cooper.
Yeah. The vision put a smile on my face.
Yes. And there are images now out there on the internet.
There are. People should try to find them. It's worth a laugh.
All right. What you got for us?
So we're looking at the third and final set of reports from the Gates Foundation's $45 million Measures in Effective Teaching, or MET, project. I warn you, this is going to be longer than a minute, but anyway, we'll try to parse this stuff because it's important. So MET's a three-year project, seven school districts partners. They seek to find out if we can reliably measure teacher effectiveness. Tom Kane and colleagues identified in 2009-10 in these districts who they thought to be effective teachers based on student gains, results from classroom observations, and student surveys. They then adjusted these estimates based on prior test scores, demographics, and so on and so forth. Then they conducted a random assignment study comprising about 800 teachers in grades 4 through 8 classrooms in 2010-11 to ascertain whether the students assigned to those teachers who they had already said we think these teachers are effective actually did learn more. Okay, we got that much? Mm-hmm. And then they say yes. Okay. Their measure, they say, did identify teachers who produced higher and lower gains, and the magnitude of those gains were actually in line with what they had originally predicted. And then they go on and say that those teachers were actually more effective at boosting achievement on supplemental tests. So they looked at other measures like the open-ended SAT-9, and they also were more likely to teach classes where students enjoyed learning based on those student surveys. So then they go into the sort of long discussion about, you know, what's the ideal mix of student achievement, classroom observations, and student surveys when you're trying to figure out which teachers are going to be successful. And they mix and match all these different weights, and they end up saying, you know, between 33 and 50% assigned to state test scores makes the most sense. Their wording, it demonstrates the best mix of low volatility, that's important, mm-hmm. from year to year, and the ability to predict student gains on multiple assessments. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the bottom line is the composite that best indicates improvement on state tests heavily weights teachers' prior achievement gains on those same tests. Mm-hmm. That's not brain science, right? We understand
it. It feels
that.
A little circular.
Yeah, but, that's right. Yeah. But again, they're saying, okay, a third to half of the weight perform nearly as well as that other better way. And this combo is better at predicting student learning on these other test. Okay. Then we read Jay Green. I always like to read Jay Green because he's got a bee in his bonnet about this. And he says, you know, when you look at actual observations and student surveys in and of themselves and whether they are predicting these test score gains, there's not much there. And actually looked at the table. He had concluded reference to a table, and he's right. I mean, it's sporadic. There's some relationship when a survey in elementary ELA, but it's not consistent across the board in all grades and subjects. So I think there's something to be said for that. But at the same time, I don't think Gates was misleading folks. I think when you read what they say, their verbiage is what it is.
Okay. All right. Woo. So a lot to unpack here. Okay. So first of all, there always seemed to be this circular logic here that said we're going to define teacher effectiveness as those teachers who boost student achievement. So we're going to see whether or not looking at student achievement identifies effective teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only way that's not circular, I guess, is if they're looking at different kinds of tests. So the teacher does well on the state test.
Mm-hmm.
Do they also have kids do well on these other kinds of assessments that might be more, I don't know, higher order thinking skills?
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. They looked at other tests, but they're looking at the prior gains, right? So it makes sense that prior gains on the same test are going to predict future gains.
Right, on a different test.
Yeah, but I mean, here it's the same state test.
That's right. So, and the Jay Green argument, as I understand it, but a lot of this is tough to quite parse, is it seems to be he's almost implying that we should just use test scores.
Yes.
That if you used basically 100% of a teacher's evaluation should be test scores, because those test scores are clearly the most predictive, and that in fact, when you add the student surveys and the classroom observations, the model becomes less predictive.
Mm-hmm. Less predictive, but more stable. So is what Gates saying. Then because people care a lot about stability, right, from one year to the next. And so there's a trade-off there. I mean, could Gates have done a better job explaining that trade-off? Yes. But did they speak out of turn? I don't think so.
All right. So what you're saying here, okay. So the J Green argument would be just look at test scores.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's the most accurate way to judge.
Although he didn't even say that in his latest blog.
Well,
but
right.
I think he's
skeptical about these teacher evaluations to begin with. All right, but that's one way to look at it. Gates is saying that is the most predictive. However, the value added scores bounce around a lot from year to year. So you're going to have these teachers that 1 year look great, and the next year they look bad. That if you include classroom observations and student surveys, which not surprisingly don't change as much, you're going to smooth that
out. Right. It's going to be more.
And therefore, it's going to be probably more people are going to trust it more. It's going to
More reliable, less predictive. So yeah, it's just a trade off, right?
Wow.
And you know, I mean, it's kind of unseemly, right? We don't really want to hear. I think in this one, it was they went up to 80-some percent. You know, when they were sort of messing with all the different weightings. I mean, who wants to? You know, that's politically dicey to say. You know, we're going to put all weight or this really high percentage on there. So
on the test
scores. Yeah, I mean, and you know, it's like, what are we? Are we reducing teaching, right? Like when we're just going to define effectiveness this way. I mean, so there are some valid arguments here.
Well, and that is the key question, is this that all assumes that teacher effectiveness is about, you know, helping kids learn more based on these state assessments, right? And so that itself is very narrow. And so, you know, it's, again, it's not surprising that the test scores matter because we're focused on the test scores. If you reject the test scores as measuring anything important, then you say this whole exercise is a waste of $45 million.
But then we got the Chetty study, right, that said, you know, this actually matters for later life outcomes. So
it does. The test score hypothesis turns out to be true,
right?
That these test scores do matter. Though the question is, are they all that matter? And are we pushing out some other things perhaps that matter just as much, we don't know how to measure them as well. Non-cognitive skills and things.
And some of these things that, you know, TFA and others have been working on when they recruit teachers, these soft measures, grit and stick-to-itiveness and all these other sort of things. So
remind me again why we're not just holding principals accountable and letting them figure out how to evaluate their teachers.
That's another debate.
I don't think I'd be really happy if the National Association of Think Tanks came out with a way for us all to evaluate our staffers the exact same way.
Scary thought, huh? I agree.
It's kind of funny that there is no National Association of Think Tanks, by the way.
Nope, and we're not going to start one, I don't think.
Note to self.
I see the wheels turning over there. I've seen that look in your eyes
before.
All right,
thanks, Amber. That is complicated stuff, but I think you have unpacked it beautifully.
Thank you.
All right, that is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week, I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.